Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, November 9th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital. Introducing Mako Robotic Arm Assisted Surgery, the latest joint replacement technology at Saratoga Hospital. SaratogaHospital.org to learn more. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month, and joining us for this Medical Monday is neurologist Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Hart specializes in Alzheimer's. Anybody who has had to deal with seeing this firsthand knows it sometimes seems hopeless. But there is hope, and we'll talk about the latest advancements in research and your questions. If you have a question, call us 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart, and your questions coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday is neurologist Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Hart is a neurologist at the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med, a center of excellence for Alzheimer's disease, where he specializes in treating Alzheimer's and related dementias. He also treats other neurological illnesses, including stroke, epilepsy, headache, multiple sclerosis, and Parkinson's disease. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call now. While the lines are relatively clear, 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Ray. It's nice to be back.
It is great to have you here. I'll start with a bit of news that crossed on Friday afternoon. Government health advisors have sharply criticized an experimental Alzheimer's drug. The panel on Friday urged the Food and Drug Administration to reject the treatment. As I understand it, it is a drug that Biogen created, known as aducanumab, which doesn't reverse Alzheimer's. It's supposed to modestly slow the rate of decline. And the reason I want to start with this, you can maybe explain to me what it is supposed to do. It is supposed to clear harmful clumps of a protein called beta amyloid. And I wondered what it is. In other words, there are other drugs that have done this, and they really haven't made any difference in the patient's ability to think or care for themselves or live independently. Why continue to go this route if it really doesn't do anything?
Well, I think that's a great question. A little bit of background. We call this Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Alzheimer presented his case study of a woman with early onset Alzheimer's in 1906. He presented pathologic data, slides of brain tissue, in which he showed two new findings that nobody had described before. One of them was these plaques of material that he called neuritic plaques. Nowadays, we call them amyloid plaques. And this is a buildup of amyloid in the extracellular space. So it's not in the nerve cells, but it's in the kind of the substance of the brain around the nerve cells. And so that's one of the pathologic hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. The other was something called neurofibrillary tangles, these twists of what we now know to be tau protein inside the nerve cells. Some more information. There are a couple of genetic forms of Alzheimer's disease. The overwhelming majority of Alzheimer's is not strictly genetic, but there's a small proportion of people who have very early onset Alzheimer's, usually before age 50, in which there is a mutation in one of three genes. And if you have that mutation, then you will develop Alzheimer's disease. All three of those mutations produce changes that increase the amount of amyloid in the brain. In addition, you may know that folks who have Down syndrome have an extra copy of chromosome 21, and that is the chromosome that amyloid precursor protein is on. So people who have Down syndrome very commonly as they get older will develop Alzheimer's disease. And so all of these cases where there's a genetic basis for Alzheimer's seem to be mediated through the mechanism of increased amyloid or decreased clearance of amyloid. So that's what has made it such an attractive target. We also know that amyloid starts accumulating in the brain abnormally maybe as much as 25 years before people develop any symptoms. So if this were a target that we had an effective treatment for, then we might one day get to the point of identifying people before they had symptoms, treating them and arresting the disease at that point. Now, what you said is correct, that there has not been an effective amyloid-based therapy to this point. There have been a number of trials which have shown tantalizing hints of benefit, but the big phase 3 studies have not. What happened with aducanumab is that they had two simultaneous phase 3 trials going on. So the phase 3 trial is the big double-blind. Some patients get active medicine at one or another dose. Some people just get placebo. Very large-scale studies that followed people over a year and a half time. They had what's called a futility analysis, meaning that when they got a certain number of patients through the study, and understand that not everybody goes into the study on the same day, so it's kind of a rolling accumulation of patients. When they had a certain number of patients completed, they stopped and they crunched the numbers and they looked at the data and they said, oh, well, this looks like a failure. We're going to stop. Now, it took about 3 or 4 months between that cutoff point and when they were able to collect all of that data and crunch the numbers and come up with that answer. After the trials were stopped because of that finding, they had, I think, an additional 600 subjects who completed the trial. And when they looked at that additional information, they found, much to everybody's surprise, that actually one of the trials hit its primary endpoint. It showed significant benefit in terms of slowing progression of disease. The other trial did not hit that endpoint, but because of a couple of protocol differences, not as many people had the highest dose of the study drug for as long. And if you looked just at those folks, then there was benefit seen. So what the question comes down to is whether that's a valid statistical method for assessing it, whether you can say, okay, well, you know, because we had to stop the trial early, it's okay to, you know, look at just this subset. And that, I think, really was kind of the question in front of the FDA. So the advisory panel has recommended against approval. I guess we have to wait to see what the full panel decides. Usually they will follow the advisory panel's recommendations, but in the last couple of years there have been one or two occasions where they have not. And while that's happening, we continue trying to find either an amyloid-based or some other mechanism-based treatment to stop this disease.
We're joined today by Dr. David Hart of the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Medical Center. And, you know, in reading up on this aducanumab, I was struck by the information that the FDA hasn't approved a new option for Alzheimer's since 2003. That's getting darn close to 20 years. Yet the research continues at a pretty rapid pace throughout the world. Why do you think this is?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. The biggest reason, I think, has been that too many people don't think of this as a disease process. They think of it as a normal part of aging, which I would vehemently object to. I don't think that's correct at all. But I think that leads to people deciding not to participate in trials. So typically, Alzheimer's trials have taken a long time to enroll patients. Some trials have had to prolong their recruitment phase. Sometimes they've had to drop the numbers of patients they were looking for. And so I think that, you know, just out in the community at large, there has not been as aggressive an approach as there has been, for example, with patients who have cancer. You know, a large proportion of patients, if they have a cancer that doesn't have a clear curative treatment, will end up going into a clinical trial to find what the best treatment really is. So I think that's a part of it. I think another part of it is just that it's clearly a complex disease. As I said, amyloid builds up a couple of decades before people become symptomatic. So it's something that's been going on in both most of the complex and the most inaccessible structure in the body. You can't, unlike you know, somebody who's having a heart problem or a muscle problem or a colon problem, you can't just go in and take a biopsy of it. Every part of the brain is used for something, and so whatever you take out is going to be sorely missed. So we've had to come up with better ways of studying patients to figure out what's going on. We've continued to try to come up with better targets. And I think the biggest thing really is that we are trying to figure out what is the best signal that people are at the point of needing treatment so that a therapy that's going to be effective can be effective in a short enough period of time that, you know, a reasonable clinical study can show that. You know, if you looked at a couple of thousand patients and you followed them for 10 years to see, you know, whether this drug or that drug or another drug was helpful, that'd be great information. But that's enormously expensive. Even the cost of doing a 6-month clinical trial is enormously expensive. And so it's not feasible to do it that way. So I think there are a lot of moving parts there. I think that you know, we're continuing to get closer. I think if aducanumab really is not approved, I think if that's the case, then FDA is likely to suggest doing an additional trial to settle the question of whether it is effective or not. That's my guess. So the FDA doesn't tell me what they're thinking. So that's certainly not gospel. But, you know, and meanwhile, we'll keep working on, you know, other mechanisms, trying to interfere with the problems in tau protein, trying to interfere with inflammation in the brain. You know, there are a lot of things that are being targeted.
All right. We'll take a quick break here and then we will hit the phones. Dr. Hart, Dr. David Hart joins us today. 800-348-2551 is the number. Your questions coming up. Vox Pop Medical Monday, Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. David Hart of the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med. And Dr. Hart, a few emails here, and then to the phones we shall go. This email came in well before the show started. This is from Jim in Glenmont. Jim writes, back in the day, many of my contemporaries used recreational drugs, including hallucinogens. Now that we're older and wiser and less recreationally active, as it were, is there any evidence that use of these substances earlier in life correlates with increased likelihood of contracting Alzheimer's? And that's from Jim in Glenmont.
Well, I think that's a challenging question, Jim. I think, you know, things that are bad for the brain are bad for the brain, certainly. But I don't think that there's any strong evidence for or against, you know, occasional recreational use of these kind of medications decades prior as a cause of dementia. But keep in mind, we also don't know in the majority of patients who develop Alzheimer's disease or who develop frontotemporal dementia or Parkinson's dementia, we don't know what it is that has triggered the problem in the first place. So it's, you know, when you're trying to look at exposures, you know, 30, 40, 50 years prior and see how that affects a late onset disease, it's very hard to show a correlation or prove that there isn't one.
Okay, this is from Christine in Water Valley. Christine says, is there a definitive method for determining Alzheimer's through genetic testing?
No, there is not. Because, for example, even if you had one of these autosomal dominant genes, meaning one of these genes that is deterministic, does guarantee that you'll develop Alzheimer's disease, you know, you might have symptoms for some other reason and not have the disease going on at that point in time. So it's there are a few genes which are very, very high risk, you know, basically a guarantee. And usually, as I said, that is for very early onset Alzheimer's disease. And that age of onset tends to be conserved from one generation to the next. So, you know, if your mom had onset of Alzheimer's disease at 45, and you get this gene from her, then you're probably going to get Alzheimer's disease at around age 45. That tends to be about the same from one generation to the next. And then there are some other genes that are risk factors. Having an APOE4 gene, this is one of the cholesterol-carrying proteins. If you have the E4 variant of apolipoprotein E, that significantly increases your risk, and it may put you at risk for an earlier onset, and it may put you at risk for a more aggressive course, depending on which study you look at. But even if you have two E4 genes, that doesn't guarantee that you're ever going to get Alzheimer's disease. So, no, there's got to be more to it than genetic testing. At this point, the best thing is a good neurologic exam. There are a couple of adjunctive studies that we sometimes do. And I think that perhaps down the road a little ways, we may be able to look towards possibly a blood test. There was a paper published this summer at the big Alzheimer's meeting suggesting that we may just be 2 or 3 years out from a pretty sensitive and specific blood test for Alzheimer's disease. So we don't have anything like that right now, but we have some research tools that are showing a lot of promise.
We're joined today by Dr. David Hart of the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med. Two more emails and then we'll get to the phones, doctor. This is from Emily. Emily writes, my father is suffering from Parkinson's, including Parkinson's dementia. His mother suffered from Alzheimer's. Is there a reason to try and differentiate whether his dementia is Alzheimer's or Parkinson's based? Is it even possible to differentiate the two? Would the medications be different? Unfortunately, he is on several medications. None of them seem to help. And that is from Emily.
I think the question that you asked that settles the answer the most is, would there be a difference in the medications? And the answer there is probably not. We have three symptomatic medicines for Alzheimer's disease that are cholinesterase inhibitors. They slow the breakdown of a brain chemical called acetylcholine. Aricept is the most well-known, but there are a couple of others as well. And so most patients end up getting treated with one of those three. They are approved for treating Alzheimer's disease. One of them, rivastigmine, is also approved for Parkinson's dementia. But the cholinergic loss in the brain of Parkinson's patients is even more than it is in Alzheimer's patients. So although these medicines are approved for Alzheimer's, sometimes they are helpful in Parkinson's dementia. Then there's another medicine called memantine or Namenda that's a different kind of medicine, works on a different chemical system. Sometimes that's of help. It's not specifically approved for Parkinson's dementia, but sometimes, depending on the situation, it might be used. Beyond that, it's really a matter of trying to address the symptoms that a given individual is having. Although there are clear pathologic criteria for making a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or of Parkinson's or of any of the other dementias based on what the brain looks like under a microscope, some people have more than one pathology going on. And some people look like they have one pathology when it's really a different one. There's not a great way of differentiating that other than, seeing how people look clinically. And in the end, it's really a matter of trying to treat the symptoms at this point.
Dr. David Hart joins us. And to the phones we now go, 800-348-2551. Doug at Saratoga Lake. Doug, you're on.
Hey, Ray and Doctor, thanks for taking my call. A question here. I know it hasn't been right on the docket today, but I have a very dear friend who's now in about her 13th month of a diagnosis with ALS, a.k.a. Lou Gehrig's disease. Any research that I've been doing seems to indicate there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of funding or whatever going into it, Doctor, and I'm just curious to know if there are places and maybe lobbying interests where we should start going that direction. It's such a hideous, slow-moving thing.
Yeah, I think that sums it up pretty well. It is a hideous, terrible disease. I don't think that it's true that there's not much funding for research. I think there's a tremendous amount of ALS research going on these days. I think some of that funding comes from the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and the MDA certainly considers ALS part of their terrain. And so if you want to get involved or make a donation to try and improve ALS research, you might think about contacting the MDA. A few years ago, when there was the Ice Bucket Challenge, it was kind of a silly idea, but it was really a startling amount of money that was raised from that. And there are a couple of treatments that are showing promise. There was a study, I think, published earlier this year with an experimental agent that I think just has a code number at this point that a couple of college students developed and with ice bucket money, and that is showing some real promise.
Yep.
So we don't have an answer yet, but there is a lot of work being done, and there is a lot of funding going to that, fortunately.
Doug,
we need more, but
Doug, thanks for the call. Dr. David Hart joins us from the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med. Did you take the ice bucket challenge a few years ago?
I did.
Yeah. You know, how many heart attacks across the country were given? I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. I don't think my cardiac system could take it. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Leptospirosis is another disease condition associated with amyloid connection with Alzheimer's.
Did you catch that, doctor?
I know you were saying leptospirosis. I think you said that leptospirosis may be associated with amyloid. Were you asking if that is associated with Alzheimer's?
Right.
I am not aware of any studies convincingly linking the two. No, I'm sorry.
Jim, thanks for the call. Over to Veronica in Albany. Veronica, you're on.
Oh, hi, Dr. Hart. I have a question about Brown Secord syndrome. I'm calling about a friend who had a severe spinal cord injury near the base of the skull where all the nerves are bundled together, and he developed this condition, Brown Secord. And one side of his body has sensation and the other doesn't. And then it's vice versa for hot and cold. And he was improving immensely through physiotherapy on his good side. But then after about a year and a half, he started to go into a decline where he was just losing all his muscle strength. And he's really getting close to being paralyzed. And my question is, would that be related to the Brown Secord, or would that just be related to the original spinal cord injury? Is that something you could comment on?
Well, Brown Secord syndrome is a syndrome of trauma to the spinal cord. Classically, a Brown Secord syndrome is hemisection of the spinal cord, which means some sort of traumatic injury that basically cuts into one half of the spinal cord. And the different sensory modalities, temperature and sharp sensation run on one side, and vibratory sensation position sense run on the other side before they get up to the brain, and both end up going to the same hemisphere. So that's why those two groups of sensory modalities, one tends to be preserved on one side and one is preserved on the other. But the Brown Secord just refers to that initial traumatic injury. It may have taken some time for somebody to give him that name, but that is the injury. If he's having a late decline now, then I think that probably somebody needs to figure out what's producing that, whether there's a metabolic illness causing him to decompensate, or there's something new and different going on in the spinal cord, or some other process at work. It's, I obviously can't make a determination of that over the phone, but if he's debilitated and he's showing a decline, it could be a lot of different things which could be making his neurologic function decompensate, so to speak.
Veronica, thank you for the call. Dr. David Hart joins us today from Albany Medical Center, and Carolyn is in Poughkeepsie. Carolyn.
Oh, hi. My question had to do with some of the supplements that have apparently shown some help to Alzheimer's and your familiarity with them. There are groups of mushrooms that will do different things, cordyceps in particular, for growth of neurons and dendrites. And I'm sure that you probably agree that people can continue to grow neurons or endings and make growth in their brain. And I'm wondering if you've heard about the use of some mushrooms in studies, and whether other sorts of focused exercises and learning new things can help slow down or retard, if not reverse, some of the Alzheimer's. And also there's turmeric. I think that's another one that's coming up.
All right. Well, so a couple of things to answer in there, I think. First off, it's well established now that the brain does make new nerve cells all throughout even adult life. When I was in medical school in the 80s, it was known, it was a settled fact that that was not the case, but it turns out we were wrong. Mm. And people can make new nerve cells, and they tend to do it in the hippocampus, which is a short-term memory encoding structure in the brain, which coincidentally is most often the first part of the brain that's targeted in Alzheimer's, which is why so many people present with memory loss. The one thing that's been reliably shown at this point to help increase nerve cell formation in the hippocampus is physical exercise. So it's funny to talk about exercise in terms of a dose, but I'm always getting on my patients to get up and be more active. There are people who do at least a half an hour a day, 5 days a week, or at least an hour a day, 3 days a week of some sort of conditioning exercise, something that gets the heart rate up and makes the muscles work, seems to lead to the release of a couple of hormones that come from the muscles and that make the brain stronger and healthier. So there is evidence for that. That's a very helpful thing. You mentioned turmeric, which the active ingredient in that, neurologically speaking, is curcumin. And that is a molecule. It's part of the spice. It is a molecule that in the test tube slows the aggregation of amyloid into amyloid plaques. And so there is, I think, a large phase 3 trial going on of curcumin therapy for Alzheimer's disease. It's certainly something that people are looking for because it's natural and could potentially be inexpensive. I would say that a few years ago, we were involved in a large clinical trial with a palm oil to treat Alzheimer's disease. It was also something that was supposed to block amyloid accumulation. And one of my colleagues, as we were heading to the investigators meeting, remarked that, you know, it may work or it may not, but at least we know it's going to be safe because it's just this simple palm. It's actually a palm sugar, not a palm oil. And it turned out that not only was it not effective, but that for some reason the folks who got the active treatment had a much higher rate of cardiac side effects than the people who were on placebo. So, you know, I think it's just because something is natural doesn't necessarily mean that it's safe. I don't know much about the mushroom literature. I think in terms of diet that there's strong data that eating the Mediterranean diet is helpful. And even in later life, converting to the Mediterranean diet seems to lower people's risk. So, you know, I think getting enough sleep, eating well, and exercising are, you know, something that we all should be trying to do.
While we're on the topic, Dr. David Hart, I've had several emails in the last 12 minutes from Dave, and Dave is very excited to have me ask you about the potential molecular link between the active component of marijuana and Alzheimer's disease, this according to the NIH, and I wonder if you might comment on that.
Well, I think that there's a paucity of data on the biologic effects of marijuana and of THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the psychoactive component of marijuana. As you know, marijuana has been in a class for which no medical research has been permitted in the United States for decades. So we don't have any good studies in humans of what these different compounds or different components of marijuana may or may not do. There have been a couple of trials which haven't been great, confirming that people who, at least people who smoke a lot of marijuana, tend to have more memory problems than people who don't. But you know, there are a lot of biologically active compounds potentially in any, you know, complex structure like marijuana, and some of them may have very beneficial effects. I haven't yet seen the data on which those are or how convincing that that link may be. I'm sorry.
Okay, let's take a quick break. Dr. David Hart is our guest from the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med, and we'll be back with more of your calls at 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. We are joined today by Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center, and let's see who has been waiting the longest. Looks like it's David in Hudson. David, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I hope this hasn't been covered already, but my father's mother and my father's brother were diagnosed with Alzheimer's at 68 and 58 respectively, and then my mother with 79. So I have it on both sides. What is there? Should I get tested for genetics? Should I just wait? Just curiosity. It's the elephant in the room in my family.
Sure. Well, I think first off, the question of genetic testing is a pretty easy one, because even with that strong family history, there doesn't seem to be any single gene that is likely to cause onset at the kind of ages that you mentioned that you know would put you at risk. So I don't think genetic testing is
56.
Yeah. So as I said, most often people with familial Alzheimer's disease will have onset in their 30s, sometimes even in their 20s, usually before age 45. Mm-hmm. So it's very rare for it to occur after that. So that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
There may be other genes of susceptibility. We don't know quite how that works. You may have to have a couple of different genes that all raise your risk a little bit, or you may have to have a certain gene and then have had a certain infection or a certain occupational exposure or something like that. That remains mm-hmm. muddy, and we keep working on that. The biggest things that you can do to lower your own risk, though, are to be physically active, to eat something resembling the Mediterranean diet, to keep your, try to keep your brain stimulated, doing different things. I always say it's unfortunate, but it's been shown that the later in life people work, the lower their risk is. I say it's unfortunate because I dearly look forward to someday being able to retire, although my wife has instructed me that's not anytime soon. But, you know, keeping your brain working, doing different things is really good for you.
David, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center joins us today. Is there a timetable for the progression of this thing? I ask for a specific reason after never having had really firsthand experience with this. A family member of ours started showing symptoms a few years ago and then was doing okay and literally it seemed like went right over a cliff at one point in the spring. Can you map the progression of this thing, or is it individually based?
I think it's highly individual. Sometimes when people go off a cliff like that, it's because there's something else going on. A lot of times, especially with women, a lot of times there will be a urinary tract infection or something like that, which is causing a decompensation. Sometimes it's a medicine that's not the right medicine or is being taken the wrong way. Another thing that can lead to people kind of falling off the cliff is some people, for whatever reason, maybe higher education or maybe good luck or good genes, may do better for a given level of change in the brain. And so they may kind of outperform themselves for a period of time. And then they may just get to the point where the brain can't compensate any longer. And then they kind of drop way down, and it's seen as a big drop because all of the other people who had as much change in the brain as them have already declined by so much that they've got a long way to go to catch up. Sometimes we just don't know what it is.
Doesn't that bother you?
Sure.
You just don't know. It seems like there are so many questions about how it starts and why somebody gets it and somebody else doesn't get it. Does it drive you nuts?
Well, certainly that would be a short drive for me, but it's frustrating, and all that we can do is just keep plugging. And I think that the science has come a long way in the years that I've been involved in it, and I think that we're slowly getting closer, and I do think that we're going to get there. So I think that. In the meantime, even though it is frustrating, these are folks who have, tremendous needs. And there have got to be folks like me, folks like the Alzheimer's Association, folks like our staff at the Alzheimer's Center and the other practices in the area that treat these patients that, help to address the problems as best we can until we have better tools.
Dr. David Hart of the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med joins us. At Back to the Phones, we go at 800-348-2551. Adrian in Columbia County.
Hi, Doctor. Hi, Ray. Both of you have the question. I have a friend who's 74 years old. He has no signs of anyone in his family ever having had dementia or Alzheimer's. However, I'm noticing short-term memory problems, like what's the date today? What day are we going to be doing this or that? Plus, he can't retrieve words. He's having trouble retrieving words. Is there an assessment process that we could go through or I could take him to that isn't a door that says this is an Alzheimer's clinic on it, which is pretty panicking?
I think the best first thing to do is to have your friend checked out by their primary care doc and make sure that there's not a thyroid problem, there's not a kidney or liver problem, make sure that they don't have a vitamin B12 deficiency. They don't have some,
I'm sorry, Adrian, your connection's not too good. Say that again.
Okay, I was thinking of the vitamin B12. That occurred to me, too.
Yeah. So I think if they check out well in general medical terms, then the next step is to get to see a physician who specializes in treating dementia patients.
Okay. It sounds
scary.
Say it again.
Yeah, well, it may turn out that what's going on is the start of a problem like that. It may turn out that that's not it at all, and there's some other explanation. So it's important to get it checked out and get that figured out.
Okay.
Okay, excellent. Thank you both.
Thanks a lot for
the call.
You're welcome. 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. David Hart joins us today. And it looks like Susan and Beckett. Susan, you're on.
Much as a question for Dr. Hart. I was just wondering if there's any benefit or any particular downside to taking Aricept or something similar as a preventative measure if you have family members who have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, even though you yourself don't have any symptoms at all yet.
Yeah, I think that there are several downsides to that. The cost, and although it's generally pretty well tolerated, every medicine has some potential side effects. And then the most important thing is that it really, from a mechanistic perspective, is not something that prevents Alzheimer's. It doesn't slow progression of Alzheimer's disease. And so, you know, it's really not something that's going to help prevent you from developing the disorder, but it's going to cost some money, and it's going to put you at risk of side effects or interactions. And so I think it's much better to get on the treadmill or the exercise bike or something like that, much better preventive effect.
Why does the exercise bike and exercise in general show some efficacy in warding off dementia?
Well, it turns out that when you exercise the muscles, that they release a couple of compounds. Cathepsin P is one. Another is BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And these are hormones which trigger this process of neurogenesis. These are chemicals that make the brain kick into gear and start making new nerve cells in the memory centers. So that is where the protection comes from. There have been studies done looking even at normal healthy volunteers. A study a few years ago looked at the size of the hippocampus across 6 months in patients from their late 20s up into their 70s, some of whom did a regular program of exercise and some who did, you know, other things, a stretching routine or something like that. And they found there was a big difference in the size of the hippocampus over the course of the study, even in the patients who were in their late 20s, who were perfectly healthy, had no cognitive problems at all. Even when you're, you know, at the top of your game, the exercise can make the hippocampus larger and stronger.
All right.
So this is something that, you know, right now is the most powerful tool we've got.
Let's go to Alex in New Paltz. Alex, you're on.
Hello, Dr. Hart. My question is about migraines, which is not related to Alzheimer's, but I hope it's okay I ask.
Sure.
I have a long history of migraines. 3 years ago, I was put on Aimovig. It's a miracle drug. I was getting 15 and more a month. With Aimovig, I was 0 to 1. In the last 2 months, I'm still taking the Aimovig. I'm getting 14 a month now. And I don't know if it's my diet or if it's my, I sleep well. I wake up with headaches. I get headaches after I eat. Any ideas?
Well, first off, Aimovig is a great medicine. It's a medicine that that blocks the receptor for CGRP, which is a neurotransmitter that's important in the sensation of pain and the spread of pain in migraine. And that the Aimovig can be used at two doses. So if you've been on the lower dose, then it might be worth thinking about the higher dose.
I'm on the higher
certainly,
dose.
Certainly. Okay.
You set up a resistance to it?
Well, I think that it's such a small molecule that it's unlikely that you would develop a an immune-based resistance to it. In other words, it's unlikely that your body would be fighting off the Aimovig and blocking its effect. We know from all of the other migraine medicines that that sometimes people, you just have to find the right medicine and then they do great forever. But sometimes people do great for a few years and then they start having more problems. Sometimes there's something you can pin it down to. You mentioned that you sleep well, so that's probably not it. But if you're awakening with headaches frequently, then it's worth wondering if you're sleeping in the wrong position or if you might be snoring or having apnea, stopping breathing when you sleep. That can be associated with early morning headaches. Looking at your diet, making sure that...
I used to have apnea. I'm sorry. I used to have apnea. Then I lost 40 pounds and I was retested and they said I didn't have it anymore, but I know I snore. My husband tells me.
Yeah. Well, I guess you should ask him, you know, if the snoring is getting back to what it was like before, or you should ask him if he is hearing you stopping breathing in association with snoring. Sleep apnea is strongly linked to carrying too much weight, but there are some folks who have sleep apnea who do not have any excess weight. And so that's not impossible. That's certainly worth looking at. And then just looking at your diet and making sure that you're, you know, not sneaking in too much caffeine or, you know, too much chocolate or the list of foods that can trigger migraine in different people is enormous. So it's very hard to figure that part out.
Well, Alex, thank you for the call. Dr. David Hart of the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med joins us today. And Doctor, I know you're not in the studio, so you won't be able to see my hand gestures. But as we near the end of the show here, we got 4 or 5 minutes left. If you hear Count Basie play the piano, that means we're wrapping it up, okay?
All right.
And here we go. Let's go to John in Coventry, Connecticut. John.
Yeah, this should be a rather short thing. I'm 86, and I've got a variety of diseases, but I acquired a non-Parkinson's disease, and the neurologist, it's lousy at explaining it to me, but essential tremors. No tremors are essential.
Essential is the medical term to mean that a problem is not the result of some other disease state. So as opposed to somebody who has a Parkinsonian tremor or somebody who has tremor because of a brain deterioration syndrome, an ataxia, or somebody who has tremor from a medication or tremor because of a traumatic injury. Essential tremor means tremor that's there just because it's there. And it turns out that essential tremor is probably related to deterioration of a certain group of nerve cells in the cerebellum. It's good that it's not Parkinson's disease. Essential tremor can be treated, but it certainly can be a very annoying problem.
She told me there were no medications for it, that I'm just going to have to live
with
it.
No, not true. No, there are a number of medicines that could be used for essential tremor.
All right, John, thank you very much for the call and good luck. Now, quickly to Teresa in Kingston. Teresa, we only have about 90 seconds here.
Hello. I am 55 years old. I have migraines and recently had an MRI on my brain. My neurologist tells me I have white matter that is typical of migraines, but not typical of the white matter, which is different than the white matter that Alzheimer's people get. Do I need to worry because I have this white matter that I'm more likely to get Alzheimer's later?
That's a hard question to answer. We have known about white matter changes in the brain of people with migraine for decades and have typically not thought of it being much of a risk factor for dementia down the road. There lately have been a couple of studies suggesting maybe it's definitely something that needs more study. People think about the plaques in the brain in Alzheimer's, and they think that's something that shows up on MRI. It does not. So he's right that if you have white matter spots, that's not a sign of Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Teresa. Well, we only have about 45 seconds here, Dr. Hart. Are you an optimistic person that there will be a breakthrough as to figuring out how to stop this thing before it really gets bad?
Well, I think it's working on getting really bad, you know, as we speak. But I am an optimist. I've been doing clinical trials in Alzheimer's disease for 20 years now. And the reason that I'm still doing it is because I think we are going to get to an answer. It's a complicated problem, but there are some really great minds working hard on it. And I do think we're going to get there.
Well, that is where we will leave it. Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center, thank you, sir, for being here. We appreciate your time.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ray.
Support comes from Nathan Letower Hospital, working to help people manage COVID-19, the flu, and seasonal colds. NLH.org for more information and appointments. Once again, thanks to Dr. David Hart of Albany Med for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. I'm sorry if we didn't get to yours. We will do this topic again. You can be sure of that. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Joe Makowicz took the calls. Our producers, Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, boy, do we switch gears tomorrow, we welcome back Richard P. Guthrie, and we'll discuss the exciting word, world of birds. So if you saw a bird today, jot it down, and we will talk about it tomorrow. That's 2 p.m. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.